The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Sandrine Ajorge, who is one of the world's leading advocates to end the death penalty and to save men whose lives are about to be taken on death row. She's been working in Texas with a group called the Lamp of Hope Project, which we'll talk more about, and the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And she's been working also with the on behalf of a French association called Together Against the Death Penalty, ECPM. Sandrine, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to our conversation for a long time. I'm glad we're doing it at last.
Me too.
So talk a bit about how you began your sojourn into opposing the death penalty and becoming such a passionate advocate for abolishing the death penalty. Talk about a bit what happened in your life to bring you to this place.
Well, it happened to me a long time ago when France still had capital punishment. I was a teenager, and a young man who was 22 was executed by the guillotine. Mm. And I just couldn't believe my country was doing that. That was cutting people in two pieces in the name of justice, and that's what got me started.
So, France abolished the death penalty, right?
Yeah, after that in 1981. Yeah, but we were, you know, very late in Europe abolishing the death penalty. We finally did, but it was a long battle.
Well, before we talk about what's going on in Texas with Hank Skinner and the other men you're trying to save, talk about the battle to end the death penalty in France and how that happened. Because I think we maybe could learn in America something from that. Talk a bit about what that was like.
Well, what it was like, I mean, first of all, we didn't use the death penalty as much as it is used in the United States. The legal system is very different. The appellate system was a lot shorter. And we had amongst several, but we had one top criminal defense attorney who saved many people from the guillotine, and he became our attorney general mm-hmm. in 1981 when François Mitterrand was elected. And during François Mitterrand's campaign, you know, it was on the program. It was very clear that the first thing he would do, the first bill he would sign, would be the abolition bill. And I remember him being interviewed during a debate, and the journalist was cooking him on it and said, you know, is this true? Are you going to do it? You know, 63% of the population is in favor of the death penalty. He said, yes, it's not a question. I will do it. People have to trust me. We have to work towards the future. This is a moral choice, but it's a political decision. You know, and it took more than 20 years after that to get below the 50% in favor of the death penalty. So if governments rely on public opinion to make that decision, it is never going to happen. Politics has to be taken out of the debate. It is not it should not be a part of a political debate. It's a moral choice for society and for the future.
What you just said was interesting, because America, clearly the majority of people in America are for the death penalty. As you said, the majority of French citizens were for the death penalty when it was abolished. But it still happened. The abolishment still went through. And I'm wondering two things. And one is how politically that happened, was allowed to happen if most people were for it. And B, how the consciousness of the French people maybe has changed since 1981, since the abolishment of the death penalty.
Well, I mean, the experience I can tell you from the work I do with the World Coalition, where I represent the Texas Coalition, and we look at the overall landscape of abolitionist countries throughout the world. First of all, 20 years ago, 51 countries had abolished the death penalty in the world. Today, 138 countries have abolished. The trend is continuing. More countries are going to abolish this year. And basically, the way people change their mind, I don't think they truly change their mind. I think a lot of people still sit on the fence. And whenever there's a horrific crime, and unfortunately, crimes are always horrific when people tend to lose their lives or to suffer, people will change their mind again. And that's why we cannot leave this to the public opinion. You know, we have to draw an agenda for the future of humanity, and the justice that kills cannot be part of it.
And so how did you then get from where that struggle to end the death penalty in France to where you are now with the battles to end the death penalty in Texas, which executes more people than any other place in the United States of America, maybe close to executing more people than any place in the world.
Yes, well, in the Western world, it's the only country that executes people. So, yeah, it's leading on many accounts and not necessarily on the best lines. But, I was a teenager when I started, so I wrote to my representatives. I started getting involved of the political actions that were done in France to promote the abolition bill. And I grew, you know, I moved to London. I started working with Amnesty International, did some work on urgent actions. I got very quickly unhappy with the way Amnesty was and still is handling or not handling the death penalty issues in the United States. I'm not talking about the great work they do in the rest of the world, but on that particular issue, they are absolutely nowhere. They issue urgent actions, but when we actually need help to work here, there is just nobody there. So I started doing urgent actions for the U.S. I started learning a bit more about cases. And in 1995, I got in contact with a young French lawyer who had done his thesis on capital punishment in Texas. So he gave me a copy. I read it. And I just could not believe what was happening in Texas. I thought, wow, this is just surreal. America is the leading model of modernity. It's the land of possibilities. How is this possible? So I started digging a little more, and he told me about the Lamp of Hope, which, by the way, I am not a member of. The Lamp of Hope is an association that was set up and run by death row prisoners. It was a unique association. They had to stop the association because death row was moved to complete isolation in the Supermax prison between 1999 and 2000. So they can no longer meet or issue a newsletter. So at that point, my friend said, well, if you're interested, you can translate the newsletter in French. We can circulate it and try to raise awareness about what's happening in Texas. And I did a couple. And then he said, well, you know, there are three guys, I think, if you want to write, that you'd get on well with. And Hank was one of them. So that's how it really started.
And talk about the Hank Skinner's case. I mean, we just finished doing several programs around what happened to Todd Willingham.
And Todd and Hank were very close friends, actually. So it's very weird to both of us that all this is happening at the same time, you know, mm-hmm. that the governor is really sweeping the case under the carpet before the midterms elections, and that the truth may never see the light of day if we leave the Texas authorities to have their way.
So to talk about Hank's case and you're how you first got involved, and we should say here that we can talk a bit about it, though it's not the most important aspect of this, that I mean, that your name is Sandrine et Georges Skinner, that you end up – you married Hank Skinner.
Yes, we are married, yeah.
But talk about – before we even talk about that a little bit, but talk a bit about his case and why you got into it and what the issues are around his possible innocence.
Well, you know, first of all, when I start writing to death row prisoners and even later on in our correspondence, I never talk about their crimes. First of all, I don't want to know what they've done. I want to reach out to the person. So we started writing and got to know each other, and very quickly he told me about his case. I mean, at that point, I had no concept that innocence was such an issue in the United States on death rows and in prisons in general. And I started digging up. He sent me a lot of documents, and he was transparently honest about everything. He sent me everything, including documents that may not have played really in his favor about regarding his lifestyle at the time, that he was on drugs, that he was drinking, you know, but he never hid anything from me. So I was able to ask him all the questions I needed to ask. He was always honest about his answers. What he had to say about his case was always documented. It's not what he thought. It was factually documented. And well, it starts by, you know, at that point he was a paralegal working for a criminal defense attorney in Pampa, Texas, which really is the middle of nowhere. And he was really defending prisoners in the county jail and revealed absolute plots by the prosecutor and the sheriff to lock people up who had done absolutely nothing. And Hank beat them at that game several times, made them look ridiculous in the media. And the prosecutor and the sheriff really hated him. So when that horrific crime happened in his house, even before the sheriff went to the crime scene, he said, it's him, he's guilty, arrest him. So it started like that. No investigation whatsoever was done to investigate other prominent leads to other suspects. And to this day, it still has not been done. And 15 years later, 95% of the crime team evidence remains untested, including the murder weapons. a rape kit, nail clippings from one of the victims, which have organic matter under the nails, which, and Hank had not a scratch on his body when he was arrested, a men's jacket that certainly does not fit his size, which has blood, sweat, and hair, and a number of items, other hairs that have not been tested. And we are at a point where procedures prevails over the truth, which is really a constitutional issue in America, not just in Texas. You know, you can prove your innocence at a late stage, but it's too late. And attorneys in Texas will tell you the number of times they have brought exculpatory evidence to judges before an execution, and the judge has said, well, I'm sorry, your client is innocent, but it's too late. You know, that concept to me is absolutely surreal.
Well, it's the same thing as having to Troy Davis in Georgia.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm confident that Troy will get an evidentiary hearing and they will be able to introduce the witness recantation. That does not mean they're going to grant him relief after that, but at least it's a step.
So
in Hank's case, it's been a legal battle. Hank is lucky, more lucky than most guys on death row, because he has excellent attorneys. I mean, really very good attorneys. And which is not very reassuring when you think that even with very good attorneys, you can't get relief in the courts because the system is just too political. You know, the judges, the state judges are elected, the DAs are elected, the sheriffs are elected. And understandably, and it's human, these people have other agendas than the truth. Their agenda is results and immediacy. They have to run their campaigns. They have to raise funds. They're accountable to their voters. So they don't want a case that's going to take 15 years to be resolved. They want, you know, the DAs on this case have campaigned for re-election on the fact that they sentenced him to death, and that many of them do. I read an article 2 days ago about two prosecutors in California who were awarded a prize for their work on the death penalty of how many people they got convicted. You know, and that is not just what justice should be about. For me, there's a major conflict of interest.
I know when I was looking at some of the websites in preparation for our conversation today, one of the things that struck me was this one website that when you did a blog post about, it's called The Skeptical Juror, the lists of exonerees from DNA and other evidence it's overwhelmingly long.
Not as far as death row is concerned, because at the moment, death row exonerations are 241 in the United States. 19 of them have been exonerated by DNA. But if you look at the overall number of DNA exonerations in the country, yes, it is important.
That's what I mean.
239 people.
Right.
Yeah. And Texas is one of the states which does have a law for post-conviction DNA testing. It was passed here in 2001. So far, only two or three death row prisoners have been granted DNA testing through this, thanks to this law. But they are mostly people who are more likely to be guilty than not. And all those who have strong cases of wrongful convictions are consistently being denied access to DNA testing. There is a deliberate choice to not let the truth out because it's embarrassing. You know, human justice is never going to be infallible. I mean, make no mistake about this, in any system, in any country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's primarily one reason why we cannot afford to enforce an irreversible punishment. But secondly, in Hank's case, as it was the case in Curtis McCarty's case, who served 19 years, on death row in Oklahoma, these were not errors. They were purposely set up cases. So these people have a lot to lose politically. You know, Rick Perry is running for re-election. He doesn't want that to come on his table right now. And I'm sure he was very pleased that the Supreme Court granted a stay and he didn't have to give, you know, an answer whether he would grant a 30-day reprieve or not, which was the only thing he could have done since the Board of Pardons and Paroles had denied clemency on both reprieve and commutation.
So in Hank Skinner's case, I mean, it's interesting that your own story about the Hank Skinner case and the fact that the two of you ended up falling in love and becoming married.
We didn't fall in love. People keep asking me this. No, we didn't fall in love. We just found each other.
Tell me what that means.
We found each other. We recognized each other the moment we wrote each other. We knew. We just knew. He's like my double, and I am like his double. You know, we are so alike on so many things. I'm his feminine, and he's my masculine. And it was just, that's just the way it went, you know. But I worked through his case, and I worked on other cases. And the more I started to look at cases and talked with attorneys, investigators, and reviewing legal material. I had absolutely no legal training, so I've learned my way through this with the help of Hank and the help of attorneys. And I just realized how rotten the system is and how flawed it is. And it's just beyond imagination. I think if the Americans understood what is wrong with their justice system, they would be a revolution. I mean, it's just surreal. It's like the Twilight Zone.
It is. I mean, especially in certain states where it's more horrendous than others, though it's bad everywhere, more horrendous than others in terms of the prosecution twisting cases and forcing people to say things that they've seen that they haven't seen, and that coming out later, and not using the evidence that they could to exonerate somebody because they don't want to go out to investigate and find out who might have really done the crime because it's too easy to convict. I mean, those kind of things. In this case, it seems like this may be the case in Hank Skinner's case, and it's a pretty frightening thought to think about that we could be about to execute a man who did not commit the crime he was accused of.
Especially when the evidence is available and in a condition to be tested. You know, in many cases, there is no such thing as DNA evidence possible. But in this case, there is. So he says it himself. You know, if they really think I'm guilty, do the testing. The defense has offered all the way through the appeals to pay for the testing. So it's not like it's going to cost the state or the county anything. You know, why not do it? Why do you have to hide? You know, what is wrong with this case? And we know what is wrong with this case. Because it's not just the DNA testing. There are a number of issues that were totally, I mean, major constitutional violations in this case. When he was waiting for his trial for over a year in county jail, the sheriff copied all his incoming and outgoing legal mail and forwarded it to the prosecution. Just that, on that, he should have gotten his trial. His court-appointed attorney was no less than the previous prosecutor who had to resign because he had embezzled drug money and was a drug addict himself. So he resigned, and as a deal, they said, well, you'll be appointed to represent defendants. You know, he was paid to represent Hank, the highest ever paid fees in Texas, and that amount matched exactly an IRS fine he had to pay, otherwise he was going to jail. So the guy just did not defend his client. He didn't even tell his own toxicology expert that Hank was allergic to codeine, and it was documented in his medical record since he was 17. I mean, he didn't call to testify a number of very important witnesses. The guy really didn't do a job. He gave his assistant, who was the new DA, and the judge, he gave them a win in exchange for a large amount of money. So they just sold him out. And in Texas, they don't care. You know, the value of a life just doesn't mean anything, especially when that person has a lifestyle that doesn't fit a sense of politically correct, you know.
So tell me what you do now in terms of Hank Skinner's case and what you expect to do while you're here in the States and while you're in Texas.
Well, at the moment, we should not move a finger until the Supreme Court rules whether it accepts the case or not. It's, to my knowledge, very unusual that they grant a stay to give themselves the time to make the decision whether they will accept to review the cert petition or not. It's a good sign. Also, people need to understand that what is at stake with the Supreme Court, even if they take the case and rule in his favor, will not grant him the DNA testing. The only thing it will do, it will give him the right to pursue his complaint in civil court against the DA because she's still refusing to release the evidence to the defense for private testing. You know, his attorney are raising a very important question that the Supreme Court is going to have to review and decide, because in some states, you can go for DNA testing, apply for DNA testing through the civil process or through the habeas process. In some states, it's habeas only. In other states, it's civil only. So that's a technical legal point that has to be clarified. And if he's allowed to pursue the lawsuit against the DA, it doesn't mean he's going to win it. So we know we are a long way away from the DNA testing unless the DA is pressured from everywhere, every possible angle, to grant the DNA testing, which he can do without any court order.
So I keep thinking as I'm reading all this stuff that, you know, I remember that back in 1997 we did a series of shows, and I was the only person allowed in the world of radio to talk to Flint Gregory Hunt before he was executed.
Yeah.
And Flint Gregory Hunt was a man who did not say that he didn't commit the crime that he did, but he had transformed himself into such a powerful figure inside the prison. in terms of working with young people, young inmates, yep. the work he did, and just trying to reach out to the family of the victim and trying to kind of live a different life. And I think that part of the problem is that as I've been working with this over the last bunch of years, is bridging that gap of understanding for people about the notion of familial reconciliation, that there are actually Absolutely. Families of victims who yeah. would do this. That if there's somehow he get that understanding and that dialogue created, it might be.
Well, we do a lot of work in Texas with members of victim families and exonerees, because it does talk to the public. It actually raises awareness when people who have lost a loved one are able to say, no, I am not looking for vengeance. Justice is not vengeance. We need to move on. We need to reconciliate, and we need to understand. We have had two or three key figures on death row in Texas who have been executed and were absolutely rehabilitated and played a major part for other people on death row, for victims' families, for the movement in general. They had become different people. But I don't know about the northern part of the United States, but in the South, there's an absolute confusion between vengeance and justice, and unfortunately, politicians are using that as an argument for their campaigns. And it's wrong because, you know, if we do have a justice system, it's primarily because we cannot and we should not rely on the emotional trauma that victims' family and victims are enduring. Of course they are suffering, and that money should really go to helping those people. Most of them are totally abandoned to their pain and their suffering, and we're spending millions and millions of dollars to execute people and not looking after the victims or their families and working on crime prevention programs. And that is so wrong because we're just regressing. We're not advancing anyway in a good direction for the future.
In all the years you've been fighting against the death penalty and fighting to save these men's lives on who sit on death row, whether it was in France or now in the United States, or wherever else in the world, this is different because you, as you said, found each other with Hank Skinner. And this is it takes what you're doing to, it seems to me, a much more deeply emotional place than all the others. Or maybe I'm reading that wrong.
Well, yes and no, but I've always separated my personal life from my abolitionist life, which has sometimes been very complicated. In fact, most of my friends at the Texas Coalition or at the World Coalition, for that matter, did not know I was married with Hank. It's only because his first date was scheduled for the opening day of the World Congress on February 24th, that during our last meeting when we're finalizing the scientific program for the Congress in December, I had to say in the middle of the meeting, I said, guys, I'm probably not going to be in Geneva. And they all went, what? We've been working on this for a year and a half. I said, I know, but you don't know this, but my husband is on death row in Texas, and he has an execution date for February 24th. So everybody just fell off their chairs. A lot of people in my professional life had actually no idea. I mean, the stuff has gotten lots of media coverage in France, so now everybody knows. But I purposely kept it private because I am not an abolitionist because I have a relationship with Hank. I was an abolitionist long before I met him. And God forbid, if he is to be executed, I will be long after. So for me, our private life was always private, but it was sometimes conflicting. Yes, it's been difficult to deal with both aspects.
I wonder, if, Sandrine, if you would just like to leave us with a couple of thoughts about this case and what you think happens next as we try to stay in touch with you and this case.
Well, what's going to happen next? Hopefully, sometimes in April, we will hear from the Supreme Court whether they accept the case or not. If they accept to review his case, then obviously the stay will hold. We don't know whether they will rule by the end of the session at the end of June, beginning of July, or it will wait until the fall. And then if they rule in his favor, then he will pursue his civil lawsuits against the DA. If they deny him, the stay will be lifted. He will get a new date. If they don't accept the date in the coming month, the case in the coming month, he will get a new date. Then there are no more legal avenues to pursue. So then it will be a matter of preparing a massive campaign to put pressure on the governor and on the DA, and specifically on the DA, to actually grant the DNA testing. You know, it will all be down to her decision because the governor can only grant a 30-day reprieve. And if we are not going to get any court decision or potential court decision to grant the DNA testing, there's no point. So that's the uncertainty that we are in at the moment. So half of me obviously is very relieved and happy, but the other half is very anxious until we know exactly, you know, what the Supreme Court is going to do.
Sandrine Ajor-Skinner, thank you so much for taking the time with us today, and we look forward to staying in close touch with you about the case and your work, and having you back on the show again very soon.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark.
Take care. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. In this month's issue, four teams of collaborators explore four very different visions of the city. It's the Urbanite Project, a special annual issue devoted to showcasing outside-the-box thinking from Baltimore's most creative minds. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbaniteBaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.